Welcome to Palmdale United Methodist Church's podcast for Sunday, February 2nd, 2020. May God use this as a blessing to you today. Let us pray. Oh God, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight. You are indeed our rock and our redeemer. Amen. This story is told by the Seneca people and others from the Iroquois nations who lived in the lands between the Great Lakes and portions of the East Coast. It's called the Storyteller's Stone, and it tells of a young boy out hunting. When tired, he climbs upon a great stone to rest, and while he drifts in and out of sleep, he's told a story, the first story. He's fascinated and so grateful that he leaves a gift for the stone, the squirrel that he has just caught. And he asks if he could come again. Initially, he doesn't hear a reply, but he's so enchanted by the story that he comes back the next day. He's finished his hunting. He places the animal on the stone. He lies down next to it and listens. Another story is given, and the next day, another still. At home, he is scolded for not having any game and not contributing to the clan, but he begins to tell the stories that he has been given. Eventually, he tells them of the stone and the gifts he leaves behind in exchange for the stories. And every night, he takes them to the beginning of time. He tells them of truth and lies, of war and peace, of how things came to be the way they are and how to live, of where to find medicine and what to do in hard times. One day, while sitting on the rock and being quiet after a story, the boy asks how he can keep all the stories and not lose them. The great stone tells him he must find a stone for each story. Put the stones in his game pouch and keep them. They will help him remember. Each time he takes out a stone, he will know its story, and he can keep them with him. Welcome to the fourth week in our series on Christianity and world religions, and we're at the midway point today. And I'm going to pull us back a little and take us on a bit of a tangent. I mean, each week in the series, we've gotten to know a different one of the world's major religions. We started with Islam, then Hinduism, and last week, Judaism. We'll continue next week with Sikhism, followed by Buddhism, and wrap everything up with Christianity. What are the core beliefs of our own faith after having heard many of the others around the world? But today I'd like to spend some time looking at Native American spirituality. Here's a map of the state of California and the approximate territories of the Native peoples who inhabited these lands prior to Western expansion. According to the California Native American Heritage Commission, there are 165 Native American tribes living in our state alone, more than any other state in our country. Here's a close-up of that map, and I know you can't read the words, but there are four primary tribes that used to roam these territories. The Kwaisu, just north of us, the Kita Nimuk south of Mojave, the Serrano in and around Palmdale and Lancaster, plus quite a few areas to the west, and the Tatavayam to the east and the south of us down to Newhall. So it behooves us to pay attention to our Native brothers and sisters. They were here long before any of us arrived. And so today we get to know a bit about their spirituality. And as you can imagine, the topic as big as Native American spirituality is far more encompassing than I'm able to do justice to it in just 20 to 30 minutes. So let me say from the start, this is just a brief introduction to a portion of Native American spirituality. We'll just be dipping our toes, so to speak, in the waters today, but I felt it important to do so nonetheless. And hopefully it'll inspire you to do your own research and reading and explorations far beyond the time that we have together in worship this morning. By the way, by no means does all of Native American spirituality sync up with Christianity, but I'll be sharing how I've learned about Native American spirituality from the perspective of our Native American Christian brothers and sisters, from their lives, their teachings, and their writings. When the Great Spirit walked among us is a retelling of the Gospels from a Native American perspective. It's written by Reverend Terry M. Wildman, a United Methodist Native pastor. whose heritage includes the Ojibwe people from Canada and the Yaqui from Arizona and New Mexico. My mother-in-law, Joanne, let me borrow this book, and I'd like to read a portion of his retelling of John chapter 1. Long ago, in the time before all days, before the creation of all things, there was the story. The story was face to face with the Creator and was the same as the Creator. He was with the Creator in the beginning. The story made everything there is. Nothing was made except by Him. Life was in Him and shined its light on all human beings. This is the true light that comes to all the peoples of the world and shines on everyone. His light shines into the darkness of this world, and the darkness cannot put it out. Even though He made all people, not everyone recognized Him. Even His own tribe did not welcome or honor Him. But all who welcome and trust Him receive their birthright as children of the Great Spirit. They are born in a new way, not from a human father's plans, but born from above. The story became a human being and lived as one of us, the great storyteller. We saw how honorable He was, the kind of honor that comes from being an only son to a father, one who is fully trusted and favored. In his book, The Four Vision Quests of Jesus, Stephen Charleston makes a powerful connection between the native people and the Hebrew people of the Old Testament. He writes this: "The people of ancient Israel were not unique in their religious experience. Like them, my ancestors believed there was one God. Like them, they believed they had been called to be God's people. My ancestors believed they were in a special covenant relationship to God, which is why the names of our North American nations translate into the people. Israel believed a sacred land had been given to them. My ancestors believed a sacred land had been given to them too. They were stewards of this land by virtue of their relationship with God. Israel believed their nation was founded in an exodus, a migration into the promised land. My ancestors had the same memory of a migration to their promised land. Israel believed God raised up prophets to teach the people. So did my ancestors. Finally, Israel believed that one day a Messiah would appear who would lead them to the next chapter of their sacred history. I believe Jesus is the fulfillment of both the Hebrew covenant and the native covenant." Stephen Charleston, the author, was born and raised in Oklahoma as part of the Choctaw people. He's a retired Episcopal bishop and served as an adjunct professor at St. Paul School of Theology as a professor of Native American Ministries. That's also a United Methodist-related seminary. His book, which I just referenced, The Four Vision Quests of Jesus, is an amazing read. I devoured it over the last 10 days. In it, Stephen chronicles his own journey as a Christian and how he came to embrace both his Christian faith and his Native American ancestry, something that isn't always easy for Native peoples. Stephen is Choctaw, and he says that for his people, Christian theology resonated with Choctaw spirituality. So they willingly evolved into a Christian nation as an expression of their own culture. He was raised to believe that despite the many hardships that the Choctaw people have endured over the centuries, many at the hands of the United States government, Christianity was the one thing they could cling to in times of trouble. In Bishop Charleston's book, he speaks about the native tradition of a quest, or vision quest, traditionally viewed as a rites of passage experience for Native American youth. Charleston expands it as something that all people can experience. He says it's the process by which human beings search for the holy. It's an act, he writes, of placing ourselves in the way of grace. We're looking for that point of intersection where we think we are most likely to encounter God. There are four components to a quest in the Native American tradition. First is a time of preparation. The quest is intentional. It's planned movement towards the sacred. Among the most common practices of preparation is using a sweat lodge. It's a form of communal worship and prayer. The cleansing of the sweat lodge is not only the release of toxins from the body, but also a deep focus on healing prayer in one's life. The second common element to a Native American quest is the presence of others. Any man or woman setting out on a quest in the Native American tradition would have at least one other person, and quite often a circle of family and friends that help them along the way. They would be under the care of an elder, usually a respected medicine man or woman, a recognized spiritual teacher of the people. These supporters would also join in the ritual of purification, getting ready to send this person off on their quest. Third, every quest in the Native American tradition has to be some sort of challenge. The quest is not an easy experience to undergo, says Charleston. It's not unheard of for a traditional Native vision quest to last up to 4 days without food or water. During that time, the person stays awake, remaining in one sacred space, usually a lonely place in the natural world where he or she is exposed to the elements. The vision quest is not for the faint of heart, he writes, and it is not to be taken lightly. The fourth aspect of a Native American quest is difficult to translate from the original, but Charleston says perhaps the best term for it would be that the nature of the quest is a lament. In some Native languages, the quest is described as a time of crying. It's not a test of how strong or how brave a person can be, but instead it connects more to how vulnerable one is willing to become. The Native American quest was designed to produce transformation. It wasn't a private experience for an individual, but more like a way in which the community would prepare, support, and develop functioning members of their society. It helped a person both understand the spiritual nature of life and their role in that, which is why people would often return from a vision quest with a new name, a name change. Now remember, the purpose of this quest is to encounter God, who is the source of all mystery. So Charleston says, in many ways, the quest is sacramental. It's the process by which the substance of everyday reality becomes transformed by the power of God. In the majority of his book, Bishop Charleston shows how the incarnation, or Jesus' life on earth, can be seen as God's vision quest. That God experiences a time of preparation, Jesus' time and temptation in the wilderness. That God expresses a need for supportive community, Jesus' experience on the Mount of Transfiguration with Peter, James, and John. God endures a test on behalf of all people. This was Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane when his disciples couldn't even stay awake and pray with him. And God makes a transforming lament that heals the world through the crucifixion. Jesus, the great storyteller, became part of our tribe so God could speak to us all and remind us what's truly important in life. It's an amazing and riveting read, and I highly recommend it. In her book, Keepers of the Story, Megan McKenna retells this Native American tale. Once all the people lived on top of the mesa. It was a good life. They were safe from their enemies below and could easily guard the few steep ways up. They relied on the winds, the spirits, for water. They lived close to the sky and in harmony with the seasons, following the old ways, the rituals, the prayers, the dances that so delighted the spirits of the place. Because it was a good life, there were some, and as time passed, more and more, people who gradually, well, they fell away from the old ways. They took for granted the goodness of the rain, thunder and lightning, the water, the coming of spring and winter. They neglected to pray, to be thankful, and to acknowledge what was given was all a gift. And the Great Spirit was not pleased. Warnings were given, less water, too much water, harsh winters, equally harsh summers, but few heeded the signs. One year it was worse. There were only a few old ones willing to do the dance and tell the stories and offer corn to the Great Spirit and thanksgiving for the harvest and in hope of good plantings. There were not enough people to do these things with respect. That night there was a terrible storm and all the paths up to the mesa were destroyed. There was so much destruction of homes and the carefully preserved water that in the morning when the sun appeared, the people realized to their horror They were trapped on top of the mesa with no way down. The days and weeks passed, there was no rain. There was less and less food, and finally no water. The people prayed, they sang, they danced, but the sky was unresponsive. It would thunder and clouds would gather and approach, but no water would fall from the skies. The people cried out, pleading and moaning. In time, there was only silence from above, except for the sound of the winds, the spirits singing in the night, faint echoes of a people that once was strong. But the mesa is now inhabited again by families that honor the old ways and keep the steep steps up toward the sky passable. And they show visitors around their pueblo and they tell the stories, emphasizing the need to remember, to sing, to pray, and to be grateful for all. Native American United Methodist Church is helping do just that, making a place where people can remember to sing, to pray, and to be grateful for all. Located in Anaheim, California, Native American UMC is under the leadership of Pastor Greg Douglas. Both of Pastor Greg's parents were born and raised in Kansas, but they didn't meet and get married until they were both living in Southern California. His mother was from Cherokee, Kansas, part of the Cherokee Nation. His father was from Ingalls, Kansas. Pastor Greg has served a number of churches in the CalPAC annual conference and was appointed to Native American UMC 10 years ago. He graciously carved out about an hour and a half of his time to talk with me about how his congregation lives out their faith as Native Americans and as Christians. Native American UMC was formed in 1960 when Taylor Harjo, a layperson from the Oklahoma Indian Missionary Conference, traveled to LA to attend school. Many of you know that hundreds of American Indians had been relocated to Los Angeles in the early 1950s by the Eisenhower administration. Harjo helped organize a community of Methodist Native Americans, and they started meeting at Hispanic UMC in Los Angeles. The community moved to Huntington Park UMC in 1976, Temple UMC in 1978, and Norwalk UMC in 1983, but it wasn't until 1996 that they found a permanent home in Anaheim when they merged together with Trinity United Methodist Church. Though their weekly worship attendance is small, Pastor Greg says there's approximately 12 different Native American tribes that are represented in their congregation, including Cherokee, Kiowa, Chickasaw, Choctaw, Muscogee, amongst others. Pastor Greg admitted that one of the biggest challenges for their community is the reality that many Native Americans grew up being told that their native practices were incompatible with Christianity. Native American United Methodist Church tries to help them both reclaim and reaffirm that heritage within a Christian context. At the close of the 19th century in the United States, life was very difficult for Native Americans. Listen to how Bishop Charleston describes the situation. The United States occupied Native lands with its military and permitted no form of self-government for Native people. Native religious traditions were outlawed as devil worship and prohibited as forms of sedition. The historic ways of life for the people was totally destroyed as the herds of buffalo were intentionally exterminated in the thousands. Native Americans were placed in the equivalent of concentration camps. Their children were taken away from them and forced into boarding schools where they were only allowed to speak in English. If the conditions in which the people lived during the time of Jesus brought them to long for a Messiah, imagine how deep the longing was for Native Americans. We Americans must also never forget the Trail of Tears. At the beginning of the 1830s, nearly 125,000 Native Americans lived on millions of acres of land in Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, North Carolina, and Florida, on land that their ancestors had occupied and cultivated for generations. By the end of the decade, very few Natives remained anywhere in the southeastern part of our United States. Working on behalf of white settlers who wanted to grow cotton on the Indians' land, the federal government forced them to leave their homelands and walk thousands of miles to a specially designated area known as Indian Territory, west of the Mississippi River. Thousands upon thousands never reached that destination because they died along the journey. And it wasn't until 1978, when President Jimmy Carter signed into law the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, that our Native American brothers and sisters were legally allowed to practice their religious beliefs. 1978. In spite of what the U.S. Constitution had guaranteed to Americans for over 200 years. For the first time in their 400-year history between Europeans and Native Americans, the religious practices of Native nations were not banned. Charleston writes, "In no other part of the world, except in Hawaii, where American churches were predominant, was there such a concerted, consistent, and conscious effort to eradicate an indigenous religious system. Not in India, not in Africa, not in any other area under colonial rule was there an intense a level of religious persecution as in the Americas." I asked Pastor Greg to tell me about the ways that they incorporate their Native American tradition into their weekly worship on Sunday mornings. He said they begin their worship by burning sage and bringing it into the congregation. Sage has traditionally been used by Native Americans for centuries to not only cleanse persons, but also spaces. Greg said that sage was common out in California. That's why they use it. But other Native communities around the country may often use cedar as well. They bring it into their congregation carried inside an abalone shell. Next, they bring in the pipe. Bishop Charleston calls it one of the most universal sacramental objects in Native America. There are two components, the stem and then the bowl. Pastor Greg said it represents the incarnation of God and humanity coming together. Tobacco is also a part of their Native American expression of worship. At NAUMC, they have two woven baskets with abalone shells inside. One of the baskets stays in the lobby, and it has tobacco, loose tobacco, inside the shell. The other basket is placed on the altar. And worshipers are invited, if they so choose, to take a pinch of the tobacco from the lobby and to walk forward and to place it in the shell, in the basket, on the altar as an offering. After the service, they scatter the tobacco out here in their garden. Flutes are also quite important in Native American worship. Like incense that lifts to heavens, when worshipers play the flute, they literally breathe life into the wood. Pastor Greg said, the flute isn't just played during prayer time. The flute is prayer time in the Native tradition. Symbolically, he said that Native Americans also say everyone has a song to sing in their life. And often it's on one's vision quest where they discover what their song is. And the rest of their life is to be spent singing their song, living out their faith, being disciples of God. I love that image. Some other elements of Native American worship include blankets. They place blankets on the altar, different colors for different seasons in the life of the church. Traditionally, blankets have been used by Native Americans as temporary shelter, as curtains for warmth, even adornment. Babies are cradled in blankets. People dance with blankets. And boy, dance is seen as the liturgy of the Native people. That's how God is worshiped and glorified. I wish I could do an entire sermon on the role that dance has in Native American cultures. And then when they die, Native Americans are often buried in blankets. It's so important. An eagle's wing is used after the baptism of a baby. The wing is laid on the child to remind him or her of their connection to the great spirit that created all life. Eagles have long been sacred to our Native American brothers and sisters. And even though it's against the law to possess, use, or sell eagle feathers, Native Americans who are members of federally recognized tribes can obtain permits to acquire birds that have died, so they can use in their worship settings. In addition, they have two mandalas in the front of their worship space. Often confused by non-natives as shields, these ones at Native American UMC are symbolic of the four directions of the medicine wheel, as Pastor Jim led us in the prayer together this morning, the east, the south, the west, and the north. Mandalas are sometimes known as the sacred hoop or the sacred circle. I asked Pastor Greg to offer a word of greeting to us here at Palmdale on behalf of his community faith. Here's what he said.
Well, greetings. So many of the tribes, what they would say to you is Mitikoye Oyasin, which is to all my relatives. Understand, one of the things Native American Christians and others have to offer is their understanding that we are all related. We're all from the same creator. We're all from the same source, the same material. Not only we as human beings, but every creature, every living thing, and to them, even the old ones, the rocks, are living and have the same spirit and something to say to us. So one of the things we try to incorporate now within our sense is we've always had a relationship, a covenant with Creator God. Now through Jesus Christ, we get to see him and understand him and know him face to face. So that becomes very important for us, for not only the smoke that is often raised up for our prayers, or the songs that are our prayers, or the coming together of the parts of a pipe, which remind us that we all get to come together and gather in the presence of God. So we would thank you, and also would remind you that we do not say goodbye. Like within the Cherokee Nation, they would say, Dodanagai, which is when I see you again. Thank you.
Speaking of stones, before I left, Pastor Greg brought out a white bandana. When he unfolded it, I saw 6 to 8 stones inside. And he told me I could take one if I wished. That Native people will often gather stones from sites that are sacred to them and keep them as a connection to the old ones. Maybe they remind them of stories. Everything in creation has a spirit. And as you heard from the opening story in today's message, even stones can impart divine wisdom. So now when I get up each morning, in addition to grabbing my cell phone, my wallet, and my keys, I grab this stone as a reminder that I am connected to this amazing creation that God has made, that wisdom can be found everywhere if I'm willing to listen. Thanks be to God for our Native American brothers and sisters and the incredible amount of wisdom we can learn from them as they seek to live out their faith and spirituality if we are willing to listen to them. May it be so for all of us. Thanks be to God. Amen.